The rights of nature is simply a movement that argues that forming nature as a legal personality is something that can achieve environmental results better than what we call environmental law, which is simply a way of regulating pollution.
Hello, and welcome to the Inner Green Deal podcast, where we talk to inspiring guests about the human dimension of sustainability and explore the link between our personal journeys and the positive impacts we can have on the world. My name is Tamsin Walker. In this month's episode, we're going to explore rights, the rights of nature, of rivers, forests, landscapes, and whole territories. And to guide us over this complex and at times rocky terrain, I'd like to welcome Mihnea Tănăsescu, a political ecologist who spent many years studying, writing, and talking about nature rights and the political representation of non-humans. He's a research professor at the University of Mons in Belgium, and his current work focuses on the concept of political representation and the politics of ecological restoration. His most recent books are Understanding the Rights of Nature and Ecocene Politics. Welcome, Mihnea. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking a lot today about the natural world. And to get us started, I'd like to ask you about your own relationship with it and how it might have featured in your childhood. Like, was there maybe somewhere in particular that you formed a connection with outside while you were growing up?
Well, I grew up in the big wild city. I grew up in Bucharest in Romania. So one wouldn't necessarily expect to find a connection with nature there. But to the delight of my parents, I used to bring all sorts of animals home, snails and ants and, creepy crawlies.
Yeah.
Then I've spent time in sort of what people imagine as nature as well, but I definitely didn't grow up with it. And this experience of sort of being connected and interested in the natural world in any environment, I think has been quite formative, because from an early age, I've come to realize that wherever it is that you can manage to pay attention, you find elements that go beyond you and that are extremely interesting, that you can never sort of exhaust. You can't ever have observed snails enough to know everything about them. And there's something about that mystery and its ubiquity that has been really important for me.
Well, that's a very unexpected and a really nice answer. So now I have this image of you taking little matchboxes home with ants and snails in them. Was that really what you're saying, that you literally took them home as pets? Or
yes, that's absolutely right. And then one of the things I had to figure out is what they eat. And it's not as obvious as it may seem. To then bring it back to them and feed them and things like that. And I would try to bring back dogs. There was a lot of stray dogs in Bucharest when I grew up, puppies and things like that. But that never really worked with my parents.
Harder to put in a matchbox.
Right. Or to keep in an apartment. So yeah. You're imagining it right.
No. Okay. So are you able to trace looking backwards yet simultaneously forwards, where you're at now in terms of your work with the rights of nature? And is there a connection, do you think, that was formed early on through the bringing of insects home or observing snails?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think it's tempting, and in some sense it's inevitable to make up stories about how we end up where we end up. And somehow often when I look back, I see things that are still there, but they were nascent or that I wasn't aware of. In a way, I think the basic insight of my childhood hasn't really changed, which is the idea that observation and paying attention is a kind of sensibility that needs to be cultivated. Mm. And one of the things that has been really sort of influential for me and important was when I realized that one of the things that modernity and our modern life has done away with is the ability to extend that sensibility to the natural world. Mm-hmm. understood, again, broadly. It can be in the city, it can be in your home, it can be anywhere. And in a way, that kind of sensibility can't be turned off because it's part of our animal bodies.
Yeah.
But it can be directed at other things. So now, for instance, I have a child, and teaching her when she was really young to cross the street, I realized just how much awareness you need to have as a human being to navigate a crosswalk. And that same kind of awareness can be applied to non-human creatures. We just don't. Mm. And in a way, that's a vacuum that is quite aberrant in human history. We've always paid attention to the natural world. And something that keeps coming back in my work in trying to understand how that can be stimulated and what that has to do with sort of bigger environmental crises like biodiversity loss, pollution, climate change.
It's good to hear that, because that is something that I want to get into a little bit later with you, this connection and how we can perhaps reconnect with certain things that we've lost in terms of our relationship with the natural world. But how do you define the rights of nature? What are they?
I think the best way to start is not from the rights of nature, but from what it means to have a right. So a right, first of all, is attached to what's called a legal person. So you need to count as something that can have a right, actually as someone, in the system of law. If you are a legal person, like corporations, like ships, like monuments, like lots of things that are not human, then you're recognized as someone that can have rights. If I have a right and I have a claim to being treated in a certain kind of way that respects the norm. So the idea at the beginning of this movement for giving quote-unquote nature rights is that the natural environment doesn't feature as a legal person, though there's lots of things that aren't people that do. And the problem with that, according to its proponents, is that it cannot therefore count in the same way in law. So then you cannot represent it as well as you could unless it's also a legal person with its own rights. Mm-hmm. And what that means, for instance, is that a lot of times damages to a natural environment are only taken into account via the proxy of human interest and not according to the damage to the environment itself. Therefore, reparations are given through the proxy of a human for damage to property, for example, but they don't necessarily go into a fund for the restoration of the legal person X environment. Mm-hmm. So the rights of nature is simply a movement that argues that forming nature as a legal personality is something that can achieve environmental results better than what we call environmental law, which is simply a way of regulating pollution.
Okay.
It's saying, you know, this is the amount of damage that is acceptable and you can't go beyond. Whereas the rights of nature says, well, no, we always have to consider the environment in its own right and irrespective of human interests. So this is sort of the basis. And then, of course, you have lots of questions about how that can work, etc.
So next question, how do they work in practice? Can you give an example of how the natural world has benefited from that legal status?
Sure. Ecuador is one of the first cases where the rights of nature have been enshrined. And it still is the first that has them in the constitution because of a whole series of political movements. The constitution of the state was rewritten, and there's four different articles in it that give rights to nature without specifying it any further. And the constitution also says that anybody can represent nature in court to protect its rights. And the specific rights are to existence, to the reproduction of its vital cycles, to evolution, and to restoration when damaged. This is one case, and I'll come back to the second part of your question, but just to say that this is unique in that it's a constitutional level, so it has the potential of really influencing a lot of things and a lot of politics. But there's also other cases like in Aotearoa, New Zealand, in Spain, most recently, the Mar Menor is a legal person and has rights. And in each case, this is done differently. And something that I really want to underline is that it's good to talk about the rights of nature as such, but when it comes to it, every place will do it differently because of their different cultural, political, legal context.
Okay.
So when I'm talking about Ecuador now, coming back to the example, we're not talking about a recipe. We're talking about, in this particular context of constitutional rights, this is what is happening. That illustrates a bit of the potential and the drawbacks. So coming back to Ecuador, the early cases of implementation of the rights of nature weren't very promising because anybody can use this rights, and it's in a lot of cases the Ecuadorian state that has done so in order to then further its extractive interests, particularly oil extraction. So for instance, it's used them to evict artisanal mining from particular areas, and then, you know, those same areas are mined industrially. So there's, you know, kind of a cynical use, as it were. But that's, in a sense, less interesting. The more interesting part is since 2009, where the Constitutional Court of Ecuador, because of new judges coming in, became quite progressive. And in Ecuador, the Constitutional Court can select cases from lower courts that are of national interest and open them again, as it were, and pass judgment on these cases. And the court started selecting cases around the rights of nature in order to start giving content to this idea and at the highest level, and therefore be able to form, as it were, a definition of nature and a way of implementing these rights that can be passed on to lower courts, because it's also a legal doctrine in Ecuador. To give an example of what then happened, for instance, the most famous case so far is the Cedros Forest, called Los Cedros, where the Environment Ministry had already granted an environmental permit for resource exploration. So there was nothing illegal about this permit, to a company that wanted to see what's there to potentially be exploited. The Constitutional Court opened the case up on behalf of the rights of nature. Plaintiffs brought suit saying, well, this is not okay. This doesn't respect the rights of nature. And what the court ended up doing is canceling the permit and saying, well, in fact, the current environmental law is not constitutional.
Okay.
Because it does not respect this particular constitutional provision. So basically, it intervened in a way that is hard to imagine outside of this framework. So because of the constitutional nature of these rights, it could then say, well, no, we have to rewrite our environmental laws in order to accord with our constitution. This has worked in a bunch of other cases that are similar, but also each one with its own specificity. And there's lots of questions that are being raised.
Yeah.
You know, these things can be rolled back.
Yeah.
Which is all to say that this is a very interesting mechanism that had this kind of result, but there's nothing automatic about it.
Yeah, that is very interesting. But so you have to have what you've been describing here. Had it not been in the Constitution, then there wouldn't have been these trickle-down benefits. But getting it into the Constitution in the first place, I mean, that's probably not something that's going to happen on a broad scale anytime soon.
Not necessarily, but there are, for instance, programs at the UN that are pushing for a universal declaration of the rights of nature. But again, I would caution again, thinking that, you know, the Ecuadorian experience is generalizable everywhere.
A couple of things that came up for me while you were explaining all of that. And if I were to go out on a limb here, I would say that the idea of giving rights to a river, for example, does remain a pretty abstract concept for many people. And, you know, maybe one issue that arises there in people's minds is, you know, a river cannot speak for itself. That's pretty obvious. Who gets to speak on behalf of the river? And where does the potential for self-interest stop and start?
Right. That is a million-dollar question, isn't it? Different jurisdictions have done this differently. So in Ecuador, anybody can speak on behalf of the rights of nature. In the Whanganui River, for instance, in Aotearoa, New Zealand, it's only the Whanganui Iwi, so the Maori ancestral inhabitants of the river that can speak on behalf of the river. And I'll get back to that in a second. But humans speak on behalf of others routinely without it being problematic. And somehow we have this blockage, right, of saying, well, you know, the river can't speak for itself. You know, doesn't science and ecology speak with a river voice when it discovers patterns, right, that are part and parcel of what the river is? That's an aside. But In the cases of New Zealand, the particular legal arrangement there is very much related to the history of the relationships between Maori groups and what's called the Crown, which is the New Zealand government. Those relationships have not been easy. Mm-hmm. And what Maori groups have claimed for a very long time is that they have never given up sovereignty over their ancestral lands. Mm-hmm. Long story short, there is this process in New Zealand that started in the 70s and then really took off in the 1980s, where Maori can enter into negotiations with the government over breaches of the foundational treaty of New Zealand, which is an understanding that goes back to 1840 between the Crown and Maori groups. Mm. And Maori are saying, look, in this treaty, we never said you can have it all. So we're now claiming that you've breached this treaty and we can enter into negotiations about how this can be repaired. And in this particular cases, and let's take the Whanganui River, for instance, because it's much better known, the Whanganui Iwi means a tribal unit, entered into negotiations saying, you know, the river is our ancestral home. You've appropriated it, done all sorts of things, including a hydroelectric dam, tourism, resource extraction, without really respecting the way that we conceive of this place and what it means to us. Mm. So basically, a compromise solution has been to say, okay, the river is a legal person. Mm. And therefore, the issue of ownership is solved by the river owning itself. Now the issue is, well, who speaks for it? And there we go into politics, basically. So what this act of parliament does is saying, now we have a self-owning entity, mm-hmm. and the law makes a board which is the one that can legally speak for the legal person, Whanganui River. The board is formed by half Maori membership and half Crown membership. So in a way, it forces a dialogue mm-hmm. that forms this river voice. And I really like the way that the Act of Parliament calls this, which is the human face of the river. And I think that's really beautiful in the sense that the river does speak in many ways, but for it to speak politically, you need this kind of institutional arrangement mm. that will be decided upon in contextual ways.
Yeah, it's a very interesting example. I'm thinking also about the board, as you describe, you know, presumably that's made up of a decent number of people so that there is also mitigation against self-interest at some point taking over. I mean, that's still going to remain a potential always, right?
But I mean, if we function with an ideal of purity, we won't do anything.
Oh, shame. Okay. Can I ask as well, because you mentioned the fact that there is no recipe for this. There's never going to be a one size fits all when it comes to the rights of nature. And there are also arguments against it. And one of the arguments is that it's done on an ad hoc basis, or another argument also that it doesn't actually provide a very clear framework for how humans have to behave in interacting with that particular entity. How do you respond to those kinds of arguments?
I obviously agree with the fact that it's not a one-size-fits-all, and that's why those criticisms have to be anchored. You can't simply say the rights of nature don't provide a framework. Well, I just gave you an example where they provide a very detailed one. Yeah. Right. There may be other places where they don't provide the framework, or where the framework is not workable. One case that is often quoted as well is a case from India, where the Ganga, Ganges, and the Yamuna River were proclaimed legal person by a particular judge in a lawsuit that didn't originally have to do with the rights of nature at all. And there, first of all, the Supreme Court in India stayed the decision. So he said, well, so wait a minute, we really have to think about this again. And second, the judge in question appointed as representatives of the river certain state bodies, state authorities, that then are the ones that brought the case to the Supreme Court because they didn't want that responsibility.
Interesting.
To me, it's an example of how precisely ad hoc decisions that are not necessarily thought through with participation from communities or from the various interests can lead to frameworks that are unworkable, can lead to dead ends, and therefore you've kind of spent that card, you know, unfortunately. But again, then, you know, if someone just levies that criticism, then I would simply turn it around and say, well, show me what you're talking about.
As you just did. So thank you for that. I mean, you mentioned the UN and what is on the table there or inching towards the table. Do you see the rights of nature creeping into Europe?
Most definitely. Spain has a national law now that recognizes Mar Menor, which is one of, if not the biggest saltwater lagoon in Europe, as a legal person with rights. And I know of many initiatives in Europe that are trying to work towards some form of rights for nature, as well as initiatives that are trying to work towards creative, different ways of representing nature and non-human beings that don't necessarily have to do with rights. Again, one of the criticisms of this idea is basically criticizing the idea of rights, not as much the idea of nature, and saying, well, you're immediately going into a litigious mode. In the Netherlands, there's this already fairly long-standing initiative that's called the Embassy of the North Sea, where there's different phases of, you know, getting to know the North Sea, then listening, and then being able to start speaking for this entity.
Okay.
But without necessarily thinking about it in terms of rights. And here, the word embassy is really interesting because it points towards diplomacy, as opposed to the inherent conflict that comes with the issue of rights.
Yeah, interesting.
And I think, you know, this is, to me, fairly uncontroversial. Environmental law has failed. You have a history of a tremendous increase in environmental law worldwide, and at the same time we've witnessed tragic environmental consequences from the collective actions of human societies.
Okay, well, that is incredibly well timed, that statement, because that was literally going to be my next question to you. You know, given that there is no silver bullet here, are there instances where environmental protection laws serve as good a purpose as would rights of nature?
There are scholars that argue precisely that in the EU, for instance, Habitats Directive, we have a legal framework that can deliver on protecting habitats as well as non-human creatures on their own terms, in their own name. So you can also have an interpretation of already existing legal frameworks that moves towards recognizing the intrinsic value of ecosystems or animals, even though that same legal framework hasn't done it before.
Mm.
And there, I think what, you know, we're pointing towards is a cultural and social shift that incentivizes judges and that allows them to interpret laws in ways that just wasn't done 20 years ago. So yes, in Europe in particular, you have this argument quite a bit. Mm. Of, well, we already have the strongest environmental protections in the world, and therefore it's just a matter of implementation and enforcement. To me, the jury is still out. I think that also depends from country to country, but there is a lot of potential in terms of European law to really step up and start going beyond this mere regulation of human activity and really thinking about the natural world in a more profound way that can have better, you know, environmental results as well.
Okay. The thing about the natural world, despite knowing and probably also just innately knowing that we feel quite good if we're walking under the trees or we are interacting in some way with the other than human world, but, you know, we persist with this hierarchical mindset that we are somehow separate from the rest of the world around us, that we haven't built. And I wonder what you think, conferring rights on nature, if that is something that can also help to shift the mindset, to kind of bring the natural world in, to give it a different meaning within human societies, that would maybe ultimately help with reconnection, help with kind of, yeah, just slowing down on the decimation.
Yeah, that's a great question. We have a very extractive relationship to the natural world where we, and this is again coming back on environmental law and how this also works in the EU. We've gotten used to, we've been sort of formatted to only value what we can quantify. Mm-hmm. And the best example of this is the idea of environmental services. So as long as you have an environmental service that you can identify, you can quantify the value of this particular thing. But from the point of view of connection and different ways of valuing, this is extremely myopic. I'll give you an anecdotal example that really touched me. You know, I was at a meeting a couple months ago, and an Australian colleague was talking about the wildfires that devastate untold numbers of hectares in Australia every year now. Mm. And she was talking about how this results in a housing crisis for koalas. And that really touched me. I said, that's a way of thinking that has nothing to do with environmental services, but recognizes that creatures have an intrinsic interest in their own life, and that to only have a couple members of your kind survive, or to only have an island of habitat, or to constantly deal with the noise pollution of marine traffic, we can empathically think about that in terms of what it would be for us to have those kinds of pressures. So, you know, what's wrong with thinking about housing crisis, right, which we keep for humans, for koalas, or thinking about noise pollution for whales, right?
That's very nicely put. I wonder, you know, you talked about the whales there and about the koalas. I mean, the koalas, maybe it's easier to reach people with koalas than it is whales, ultimately, because they're fluffy and they've got a cute nose. But, you know, how do you think, is this a question that you feel equipped to answer? I don't know, but that people can be guided towards reconnecting with the riches of the world around us. Because if we're not connected to it, then we're not going to want to protect it. Then, you know, if there is no connection, then there's nothing to protect.
Sure. Well, you know, that's a big question. I said, if you feel equipped to answer it, well, the short answer is no, I don't. But
but you'll try.
I won't try to answer it. I'll tell you a couple of things that come to mind, and that, you know, in asking myself that question.
Please. Yeah.
So if we go back to the discussion we're just having about a technical view of nature, as it were, mm-hmm. and something that is much more empathic. There's this word that Eduardo Galeano, this Uruguayan writer, has used, which is sentipensante, okay, which is feeling thinking, to describe the way that people and many other creatures are in the world. We feel think. We don't just think or feel. And in a way, the extractive mindset, the technical mindset, only thinks and removes the feeling from thinking, and therefore doesn't think very well. If we follow from that, then environmental interventions, projects, whether they be under the EU restoration law, for instance, can be either thought of in a technical top-down manner, Or they can be thought of as also a way of restoring reconnection. A lot of the problem is that we often add that on as something that responds to new criteria of being interdisciplinary or participatory or whatever. But we don't really think the issue of restoration, to go with the example, as an issue of attention, as a crisis of attention, and not just a crisis of environmental services. And if you think about it that way, then there's many projects where, you know, local inhabitants can literally do things and be remunerated for it, for example, that encourages and develops their own sensibility. Right? A lot of how, you know, restoration projects look is not very complicated in technical terms. It's just that it's thought of as outsourcing to technical firms that come in and do what they need to and consult the public. So to me, for instance, the EU restoration law is a huge opportunity to also include this kind of thinking where, you know, you can source ecological knowledge and you can also encourage sensibility at the local level through restoration projects.
That's nice. Well, maybe we connected your answers to the final question. And this question is, if there were one skill that you'd like to see everybody in the world be given, what would it be?
That's a great question. One skill. Well, I guess I'm going to work my way out of the question. Say,
okay,
what I would like humans to be able to do is to enhance the natural world. And what that skill looks like is going to depend. It can be, you know, composting, paying attention to soil, rediscovering origin, whatever. Mm-hmm. But we've lived for so long now with the idea that people are bad for nature. And I think that's part of the problem, is the idea itself. I would like people to rediscover their power of enhancing the world around it and make it richer.
I'll take that as an answer. Very nice. And then it's up to everyone to do what they can, feed into the tapestry of life.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on and speaking with me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. This has been wonderful.
I hope you enjoyed this foray into the rights of nature. Maybe it offers an opportunity to consider aspects of the natural world as entities rather than economies. I'll be back next month with a new episode of the Inner Green Deal podcast. For now, though, I invite you to share, subscribe, or scroll through the archives, which contain many interesting conversations with people working on sustainability and inner development. Thank you so much for listening. I look forward to you joining me again very soon. Bye-bye.